On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From their churches to their homes and barns, the Amish live among us and yet in a world apart. We think we know them a little from the movies and chance meetings with a horse and buggy on the highway, but most of us don't really know much. For writer Joe Mackall, a family of the world's most austere Amish, the Swartzentrubers, moved into the farmhouse next door. This hour, On Point, meeting the neighbors, the Swartzentruber Amish. Joining me now from Cleveland is Joe Mackall, writer and journalist who came to know his Amish neighbors intimately and has written about it in his new book, Plain Secrets, An Outsider Among the Amish. Joe, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
So it's not as though you went out looking for this. It kind of moved into your lap.
Yeah, it really did. When we moved out there to Ashland County, Ohio, there were a few Amish, but not nearly as many as there are now. And mainly those were old order. But we didn't have Swartzentrubers until about a couple years after I'd been there. And I didn't really even know there was anything special about the Swartzentrubers or that there was such a thing. I think I, like most people, believe the Amish were the Amish, and that was it. But I learned differently pretty quickly. And soon they became very hard to ignore and very hard not to engage.
Here you were, a city kid, but now living in northern Ohio in what you describe now as one of the biggest concentrations of Irish in the world. There's a lot we want to learn about your intimate sort of learning curve with your Amish neighbors and about the big picture as well. I mean, how many Amish are there in America today, and what's the sort of geographic sprawl?
Well, the estimates range from about 180,000 to 200,000, and that's the United States and Canada. And in the United States, they're about in 28 states. The Swartzentrubers are mainly in Ohio, and Wayne County, Holmes County, and Ashland County, and a few other bordering counties in Ohio have the largest concentration of Amish in the world.
And this is kind of up south of Cleveland, sort of north-northeast Ohio there.
Right. We're about midway between Cleveland and Columbus. If you can picture that with Columbus in the middle of the state, pretty much, and Cleveland up on the lake.
Now, most people picture the Amish, as you say, as kind of one big, undifferentiated group, but you became very aware that there are lots of different streams within the larger Amish world. Give us that picture. What are the sort of breakdowns, and where do the Swartzentruber fall?
Well, that's a really good question, because if people take away anything from my book, it's to understand that the Amish are not a monolithic people. That can probably be said of all groups, although I think it's very easy to just assume a group is a monolithic entity. But with the Amish, it is not. I mean, to generalize about the Amish, Tom, is a very dangerous thing to do, because the generalizations won't get you very far. The Swartzentrubers are the most conservative. They're the only Amish who still milk cows by hand. They only take baths once a week. Matter of fact, the other Amish, like the more liberal old order, from whom the Swartzentrubers split, they make fun of the Swartzentrubers for milking by hand.
You say they call them the grudel vulas, the woolly lumps for getting
woolly
cows
lumps,
milk
right.
in their beards.
Right. Which I haven't seen for myself, but you could see how it could happen.
Right. So
and then the bathing once a week
yeah.
is an issue they feel pretty strongly about. For reasons that are still unclear to me, I think it has more to do with they're just working so hard during the week that getting everybody, you know, like 10 kids and two parents bathed and dried off and in clean clothes is no small task. And so it's saved for the Saturday night before Sunday services.
So you've got your Weaver Amish and your New Order, your Old Order, your Nebraska, your Swiss, your Beachy. I mean, some of these drive cars, and others, like the Swartzentruber
right.
you were with, all the way back at the far end away from that.
Yeah, the Beachy Amish drive cars. The new order will drive tractors down the road. Many of them can fly planes. Even the old order in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, have gas heating in their homes and indoor plumbing, and the Schwarzentrubers still have outside facilities and very little else. Joe, I mean, Andy Weavers have it a little better than the Schwarzentrubers.
Joe, I wish you'd read a little bit from your book, and it's quite a wonderful book, I think, Plain Secrets, that sort of begins to introduce us to the Schwarzentruber environment, culture, world.
Okay, I'll do that. To be a Schwarzentruber Amish means having black buggies with one or two kerosene lanterns and no windshield, no homes with central heating, gas or electric, and no couches or stuffed chairs. To be a Schwarzentruber Amish is to have no indoor plumbing, no refrigerators or freezers, no continuous hot water, no tractors in the field or at the barn, no blinds on the windows, no wild rumspringa. Although their more liberal brethren have agreed to allow the slow-moving vehicle sign to be screwed to the backs of their buggies, the Schwarzentruber Amish have steadfastly refused to use the sign despite being thrown in jail and enduring lawsuits in several states. The Schwarzentruber Amish reject the sign, believing it to be too brightly colored and too of the world. To them, accepting the slow-moving vehicle emblem would be akin to trusting in a symbol more than trusting in God to keep them safe. To come upon a Schwarzentruber Amish buggy at night is to spy the faint hint of a lantern's red light, as if your headlights have shone on a reflector stuck in somebody's front lawn. But as you get closer, and if you're not going too ridiculously fast, although almost all of the corn-fed country boys and pickups around here do drive ridiculously fast, you'll catch what look like long silver splinters of something you can't identify, ostensibly floating independently of anything else. And this will be your signal that you've come upon a Schwarzentruber buggy in the dark, where parents and 5, 7, 9 of their young children will be riding home from a long church Sunday of worship and socializing, perched on benches in the open night, belted to their seats by nothing more than their blankets and prayers, hoping you'll see them in time to stop or pass.
Joe Mackel reading from his new book, Plain Secrets, An Outsider Among the Amish. Joe, introduce us to the family that moved in the farmhouse down the road from you, the Shetlers.
The Shetlers, the first person I met was Samuel Shetler, and he was the father. And, of course, because the Amish society is a very patriarchal one, he's the one that mattered as far as getting to know the family at all. And then I met his wife, Mary, and at the time they only had 3 children. They now have 9. But this was a while ago, and they're still relatively young. They're still in their 30s, so they have time for more children.
It's a long-term relationship. I mean, you've known them now for 10, 15, 16 years.
It's been 15 or 16 years now. 92 is when we met.
Yeah.
So 15 years.
And you were thrown together. I mean, you know, we think of the Amish as sort of picturesque but unknowable. Your path in began with a kind of a crisis in the Shetler family.
Yes, Mary was just days away from giving birth, and Samuel learned that his mother had just died in Canada. That's where Samuel was from. Mm. And so Samuel had a decision to make. It was either stay with his wife and help her with her delivery, or go and bury his mother, because he did not have time to take a Greyhound bus up and back, which is something that even the Schwarzentrubers are allowed to do. And I didn't know him very well then, and I didn't want to be pretentious, but I just volunteered to drive him to Canada for his mom's funeral and then turn around and drive him right back so he could be there for his wife's delivery if that was okay with him. And Samuel went and saw his bishop, and his bishop said, you know, go bury your mother. And but he had to get permission in order for me to drive.
To be given a ride by an English, an outsider.
That's right, in a car. And that's another big difference, Tom, is other Amish, they'll take a ride almost anywhere. Some of the old order, they'll be picked up for work or they'll be picked up to go shopping. The Schwarzentrubers are only supposed to be in a car for doctor visits or hospital or emergency situations. And I believe his mother dying and his wife about to give birth, his bishop considered that as falling into an emergency situation.
And so began a long and close relationship between you, Joe, and the Shetler family. out there with their corn and beans and lettuce and tomatoes and strawberries and cattle and cows and pigs and chickens and ducks. I mean, this is a hardworking crew with mom and dad, and there were nine kids next door.
They are always working. I mean, even hanging out at the farm while I was writing the book was exhausting. There's only so long I can watch five horses go up and down a field. You know, a better man than me could have done it, but I couldn't. But I will go over there at 7 a.m., and Sammy will be working. I'll drive by at dusk, and he will be working. And the only day he doesn't work is Sunday. And that's just not Samuel either. That's his wife, his daughters, his sons. Everybody works as soon as they can. And the Schwarzentrubers are about the only Amish left who are, they're about 70% of them still have farms and work them as their sole means of cash and employment.
Joe,
a lot of other Amish can't. They couldn't do it, or they were forced to go and open stores in town but the Schwarzentrubers, it's very important to them to keep everybody at home.
Joe, you open your book right up with a wonderful quote from Wendell Berry, the Kentucky essayist, and he says, "Nothing, I think, is more peculiarly characteristic of American society than its inability to see the Amish for what they are. It sees them as quaint, picturesque, old-fashioned, backward, unprogressive, strange, extreme, different, perhaps slightly subversive. And that sight," writes Wendell Berry, "is perfect blindness." What does he mean? I think what have you found to understand he means?
Well, I love that quote.
Yeah.
And it took me about a second before I knew that that would be the epigraph for the book.
Yeah.
Because I think I did it too. I romanticized the Amish. And that's just kind of my temperament. My philosophy is not to, you know, just look for the repression and everything else that's also there. But it seemed like people were falling into just a couple camps. They were fascinated by the Amish, or they romanticized the whole back to the land idea they loved. I often think that what we see in the Amish tells us more about ourselves than it does the Amish. And I think that's what Wendell Berry was speaking to as well, that we view them in ways that are really only about some kind of need that we have, either a need to kind of harken back to that. I mean, they really keep a lot of the 19th century America alive for us, even though they're from a different culture. They're maybe a kind of a reminder of some of the patriarchy and some of the repression that may still be prevalent that we don't like to talk about. And because of that, a lot of people around where I live do not like the Amish.
They don't like them because they see them, their culture is a heavy-handed, Papa knows best culture, or something else?
That is part of it, although I think some of the romanticizers will acknowledge that also. The people around where I live who do not like the Amish believe they're getting away with something. They'll always talk about the fact that they don't pay taxes, when in fact the Amish do pay taxes. What they don't pay into is Social Security, because they don't receive any benefits. But they pay real estate taxes and income taxes. Now, does every single, you know, Amish person pay their taxes? Well, I would ask the same thing of the rest of the tax-paying Americans. Probably not everybody, but they do not invite trouble. I know that. Schwarzentrubers do not like trouble, neither do the rest of the Amish.
Is the sense of getting away with something, is there also a sense that they're getting away with, I don't know, not having to live in part of the contemporary swirl, the rat race, the sort of, you know, chew us up and spit us out part of modern life?
That may be part of it, too. I know that they claim to be upset about the kids only going to school to the eighth grade. However, these kids are also bilingual when they get out of the eighth grade. I, too, am horrified at the fact that the Amish only get eighth grade educations. I mean, as a college professor, education, you know, has always been a lot to me. And some of the young kids that I've met who are Amish, it's just hard not to imagine what they would be if they were outside of the Amish. But I don't necessarily believe that those of us outside of the Amish community have all the answers or living the great life either.
Did you ever bring your concerns about the kids and their education up with Samuel Shetler? What did he say, or what do you say if you did?
Well, I did. That's the one thing. Samuel and I really had enough of a relationship over the years. I mean, I had written another book, and it had come out, and all this while I was still talking to Samuel about the idea of my writing a book about him and the Amish. Mm-hmm. So it took a long time before he had to trust me, and he had to feel that everything was going to be okay. And so once he agreed to do the book, he answered an awful lot of questions. And he, by the way, I should say, is an exceptional person, which you can tell by reading the book. He's a very smart guy, deeply devoted to the Amish way of life. He's not some kind of fringe Amish guy, but also very curious about the outside world, just because he happens to be very intelligent. But when I would ask Samuel about the school, he would say that, you know, I did just fine would be one of his answers, or what do they learn in high school except how to drink? And I would have to talk to him about that. Mm-hmm. But also, he believes they learn what they need to be a good Amish citizen by those 8 years of school and then being taught about life and land and faith and doing what's right in his own home, in their own homes.
You write,
so they really don't need more school.
Yeah, you write about this notion of being bound to be freed, about the very, very high awareness the Amish have of how the very tight-knitness of their community is in their view, a kind the path to a kind of liberation. Explain that to us.
Well, it's certainly a liberation from living in the sinful world, which is what Samuel's expression is for the world outside the Amish. It's not that he thinks everyone in the sinful world is going to hell, but he clearly believes that there's a lot in our world that is less than desirable, especially for him and his children. And of course, I always tell him that I have problems with a lot of things that are in his world. But the upside to that tightly bound community is the work the community does on the way they take care of each other, I suppose is the best way to put it. The community, the way the community descends on people in need put me to shame. And my wife and I started thinking about that we just don't belong to a community in that way. And I don't know too many people who do anymore.
Describe for us a great example of that. Illustration of the book was when the Shetler family lost a child. It was a moving observation of that loss, but also community coming together at the same time. Paint that picture for us, Joe.
Okay, that was their oldest daughter, Sarah, died of a brain tumor when she was 9. And you can just imagine how devastated the family was. But we were over there just talking to them afterwards, and there were Amish, Schwarzentruber Amish, crawling over everything. Guys were on the barn. They were bringing over feed. They were bringing in Samuel's hay. Or they were, the women were baking and putting away preserves. Some Amish folks came over and winterized the home. I mean, they did everything so the family wouldn't have to do anything. And they also, which is another astonishing fact of the Amish community, is that because they don't have health insurance, an elder from the Schwarzentruber community went around and collected money, and they were able to pay for Sarah's hospital bills because of the community.
Well, with
and
no
the community
insurance.
Knows no insurance.
Had they put her in the hospital? Had she had full treatment as an Amish child?
She had full treatment. They did everything. They took advantage of modern science right to the very end, and there was just nothing they could do.
And the community paying for that and went from the high-tech hospital to the very old-fashioned observance of the funeral. I wish you'd paint a picture of that scene, Sarah's body being viewed by the community, and your part in it.
Yeah, I'm still not sure what to make of that moment, and it was 6 years ago, I guess now, or 7 years ago. But my wife and I went. We were the only English, the non-Amish. They call us English people mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. Probably 300 people in the house, if you can imagine, on one floor. Mm. And Samuel led us back to the room where Sarah was. And it's this throng of Amish mourners just parted. And my wife and I walked through being led by Samuel. Mm. And when we got to the back room, Sarah is just stretched out across on a plank in between two chairs. And there's kind of this old Amish man I did not recognize with this wizened face holding this lantern up above her. And it was just getting dark outside. And, of course, there's no other light in the house. And I don't know if it was the quality of the light or my emotional state or what I was feeling for these other folks who were there, but I knew at that moment that there was something beautiful, maybe even holy, in that moment and in that life. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought it was only the Amish life that I was thinking about, but I realized even by the time I got back home that that moment just kind of illuminated a beauty and a holiness that I think exists in our lives, which I'm not sure I would have so readily acknowledged had I not been there for that moment. Mm. And clearly, I mean, ostensibly, it's not a moment, you know, it's kind of a sublime moment maybe, but it's not a moment that ordinarily evokes those kind of feelings, but I can't deny that I had them. Mm. And it happens a lot in little ways when you're dealing with these people.
They're a moment that not normally at all open to most of us. In fact, very, very few. Joe Mackel is with us. His new book is Plain Secrets, An Outsider Among the Amish. And Joe, there are a lot of listeners who would like to talk with you. Let's take a call, if I may, from Pocatello, Idaho. Lee, sure. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I'm a long-haul truck driver, and about 20 years ago, I almost ran over an Amish buggy. I missed a thing by inches on a two-lane road in Kansas about 9 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And the most amazing thing to me, first of all, I was very thankful I didn't hit this thing, but it had no lights, nothing at all. It was dark, you know, with a black horse, a black buggy. And the most amazing thing to me was just seeing this thing on the road. It was like seeing something coming out of a time machine. And also over the years, you know, I've come in contact with the Amish in the course of my travels, and some of them have started using lights in their buggies.
And Lee, as a truck driver, as a long haul, as a truck driver who you know may be fascinated, but could also run into one of these buggies. I mean, what do you think when you see that? This is nuts, or this is beautiful? Okay. Lee, are you there, my friend? Sounds like Lee's breaking up on us a little bit. Joe, you pay a lot of attention to that transport issue and issues of safety around it in the sort of sense that some Amish have. They won't even put the slow-moving vehicle sign up on the back because it's too orange and bright and flashy. They're willing to put themselves in the hands of God even when they're putting their children's lives and their own at risk.
I know, and I've talked to Samuel so many times about this because he's a minister now, and he is standing in his church. I would just say, you know, even that slow-moving vehicle sign would make such a difference because of the way our headlights catch it. Mm-hmm. And when you come over a little hill and there's a buggy right there, it is always, always a dangerous moment. And now there are some Old Order Amish who live in Wayne County, about an hour away from where I live, who have battery-powered lights on the back of their buggies that turn like cherries on a cop car. And those are great because you can't miss them, but that would never be the Schwartz and Truber way. They will never go that far.
Let's take a call from Williamsville, New York. Chuck is on the line. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how do the Amish learn about current events in the world? Do they get the newspaper? Do they have email, telephones? For example, how did your neighbor learn about the death of his mother?
Great question.
That is a great question, and I describe it as they have some kind of figurative fiber optic cables somehow that run through families. I've never seen anything like the way information travels through an Amish community that doesn't have phones or, you know, all the other things that we have to communicate. As far as current events, they hear, just like a lot of us do, some English guy has heard the news and then mentions it to an Amish guy, and pretty soon everybody's talking about it. They also get this newspaper called The Budget, which is out of Sugar Creek, Ohio, and I think it goes to almost all the Amish. And there'll be little letters, I mean, almost a letter that you would receive from your aunt 50 years ago about, we had a barn raising today, and everybody came over, and I saw, you know, Jonah Miller with his new wife, and they were there, and the crops are good. And all these letters are like that for pages in the Sugar Creek, and that's basically how they also find out about how their relatives are doing.
But your friend Samuel found out about his mother's death in time to get there all the way in Canada for her funeral. That's not a very long lapse time in the absence of really figurative fiber optic. I mean, are people sneaking right out to pay phones when the chips are really down or not?
Well, no. There are some Amish who have these collective phones that they can use. Maybe 10 farmers will use a phone, but that's not the Schwarzentruber way. In this particular case, Samuel had given he knew his mother was sick, and had given his father the phone number of an English guy that he could call, and then the English guy came over and talked to Samuel and let him know. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, and I don't see that as hypocrisy. They're very practical people as well. And, you know, it would just be silly not to know if your mother died and have her buried, and then you find out, you know, a week later. So they're amazingly practical, but then they do compromise. I don't think they would have survived this long or have their population be doubling every 25 years if they weren't compromising, making some compromises, especially with the speed that our culture seems to be flying forward at.
And the population growth, is it all through 9-child families, or are people brought into the Amish world from the outside? Are there recruits?
No. People can become Amish and have. It's pretty rare. And nobody becomes a Schwarzentruber because it's just too hard. But they have, especially the Schwarzentrubers, they retain 90% of their kids.
We're talking this hour about the Schwarzentruber Amish, the world's most guarded and conservative Amish, with a writer who came to know them intimately and well. Joe Mackel joins us from Cleveland. He's director of the Creative Writing Program at Ashland University in Ohio, former staff writer for The Washington Post, author of the wonderful new book Plain Secrets, An Outsider Among the Amish. He got to know his neighbors very well over many years in a way that you and I may never have a chance to do. Here's another fascinating bit of recording from 30 years ago, a different Amish community, Belleville, Pennsylvania, Old Order Amish. Here's a liturgical chant, a little bit of one. The religious root of a very diverse culture, as Joe Mackel describes it. Abigail's calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Abigail, you're on the air with Joe Mackel.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah. I appreciate it. And I also appreciate such a sincere view of the Amish community, about which I know very little. But I am aware of some cases in our own history where such utopian groups, we might call them, or very unique communities tried to establish themselves and tried to continue their lifestyle. And as far as I know, the Amish are really the only ones who've been able to do it. And I think that's really laudable, whether there are all positive or negative aspects that we can discuss about their choices. They've been able to maintain it, and I think that's really exceptional, and it's exceptional that they've been able to do that in this country.
Not only to maintain, but to double their population, Joe
right.
says,
I mean,
Abigail.
They're thriving, which is unbelievable. I mean, we think of so many other so-called experiments or trials to get such a close-knit community, and they do it. And I don't know about you, but I grew up in a small town, and any time you have a small community, it is extremely complex. The social networks and tensions and trying to keep things going in a positive manner for those involved. And it just seems like they know how to do this.
Yeah, Abigail, let us explore it. Joe, what has made the Amish so sort of tenacious in their survival rate and even growing in their population?
I think that's a really insightful point that Abigail makes, because you would think that they couldn't possibly survive. Especially in 2007, and here they are thriving, particularly the Schwarzentrubers.
The toughest, most conservative crew in the
right,
group.
They're even further away from contemporary America. And they're doing just fine, even better than just fine. Part of it is they are so, I mean, this is generation after generation after generation of hearing the same things from the people, being tied to your grandparents and your cousins and even your brothers and sisters in a way that we probably are not anymore, since we're scattered all over the, I mean, I have a brother in California, a sister in Oklahoma, and yet these people will be, you know, within rock-throwing distance probably from their parents or at least other members of their family.
You know,
and there's that kind of tightness, even physically, that I think helps. I'm sorry, Tom, go ahead.
Well, just one thing I noticed. I mean, I grew up in Illinois, not far from Amish, and with Mennonites in the family, closely different but closely related. And, I mean, you know, when it was canning time, they would show up, the women with their long hair and black bonnets and dark clothing and the whole thing. But I was always struck, number one, what great cooks they were, unbelievable. but also they really knew how to work, and I knew these people as family. They were good business people as farmers. They did it their own way, but they were very thrifty. They were very effective business people within their terms.
That's exactly the way I would describe Samuel and the other Amish that I know well. They're very practical, very thrifty. They can farm like nobody's business. I mean, land that most people thought could not be farmed well would thrive under the Amish. And I don't know if it's in their DNA or what, but they are amazing farmers. And they also, you know, they're very good at they don't spend a lot of money. They don't need to spend a lot of money. And they do save, and they do help each other out. Samuel's father-in-law is the reason that he could have his 86-acre farm, and that happens an awful lot. Or a son will build a house. After he gets married, he'll build a house on his father's land. And, you know, it's not, once you start seeing those things, not to mention their kind of philosophical and theological ties, it's really not hard to see how they're been able to sustain this.
And it's a whole system. I mean, the idea of surviving on an 86-acre farm for most Ohio, Indiana, Illinois farmers, ridiculous, but in Amish terms, quite doable. Let's get a call from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Ronnie, you're on the air.
Yeah, I admired the Amish a couple of years ago when there one school there in Pennsylvania, you know, had the murderer go in there and kill their kids.
You're right, the three Amish girls who were killed in school. Terrible story, yeah.
They wanted to just go in there and talk to the person and pray for him. Didn't want hanging or, you know what I mean? They were trying to pray for him and without injecting a bunch of more hatred into them.
Right, right. That was very striking, the way that after the murder, the Amish in that community prayed for him. They reached out to his wife. You've thought about that and spoken about that. Joe, how did you interpret that?
Yeah, it's funny. When I talked to Samuel about the shooting, I said, what did you tell the kids? And he said, I told him that it would be 100 million to 1 shot that would ever happen. But if it ever did, it would be God's will and you'd be with God. And that was basically the end of it. And the Amish that I know look through the act to God. For instance, that horrible school shooting, if that was God's will, so, you know, wanting vengeance on the guy who did it or punishing his wife or family would be so far beside the point because they didn't have all that much to do with it. They kind of look right through the event up to God, and that's, I think, where their forgiveness can grow out of that.
Joe, remind us where the Amish came from. I mean, this grows out of the Protestant movement in Europe. These were people who were impatient, sort of couldn't wait, moved ahead on their own, and then ended up out on their own branch.
Yeah, there was a lot of this, you know, in the 16th century, in the Reformation, and there were splits, and the Anabaptists split with their big credos being separation from the state, particularly, and the church. They didn't want the Catholic Church, you know, having anything to do with what they practiced or preached or anything else. And they believed in adult baptism. which really got them in trouble with the Catholic Church. And so they separated. It wasn't until years later that the Amish then split from the Mennonites, because the Mennonites were Anabaptists too, and they just went a more liberal, progressive route.
And they jumped to North America on the promise of William Penn's invitation.
And they landed in Pennsylvania, which is why, even though Ohio has the biggest concentration now, the county with the most Amish in the world, I believe, is Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
And the biblical...
they'll move to survive. You know, they'll move if it gets too crowded in a place. That's another way, maybe another answer to Abigail's question. That's another reason they survive, is that they, you know, if all of a sudden there are many more English and too many cars and they feel crowded or uncomfortable or in danger, they'll move.
Let's go to Al in Boston. Al, you're on the air with Joe Mackle.
I thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have two questions that I think are related, at least in the sense that they concern drawing technology lines. Mm-hmm. The first is the general... We all might have practical reasons for choosing one bit of technology and another. Certainly my wife and I do that to some extent. But I'm intrigued by the question of how certain technology would get to be prohibited, at least in general, religiously, because one time the stuff they use now was, quote, modern. And so how they could draw any kind of line saying, well, you can use this and not that on religious grounds, I'm curious to know. And another question is, for people with disabilities, do they allow the use of adaptive technology so that people can participate in their community in ways that the disability might otherwise prevent?
Al, those are great. Thanks very much. Joe, what about it first on how they decide, because and it's different in every sector, how do they decide what's sort of, you know, okay to use and do it and what's not? And you're right that they revisit this every so often. How do those fine distinctions and what's going to be allowed, rubber on the wheels or just wood or and all the rest get drawn?
Mainly the question comes down to, isn't so much a religious question as it is, what's going to keep, I mean, is this going to help our community stay together, or is it going to connect us to the world? Tractors was a big thing that they faced in cars, and they decided, you know, you have a car, and you're suddenly mobile, and you're of the world. There's nothing you can do about it. And they'll just... Some of this will come out in their Ordnung, which is kind of their social template for deciding what to do. And even that is just district to district. They have different ones. But the bishop and the other elders will decide basically whether it's okay to have, for instance, a gas-powered engine can have a belt to a table saw. It can't be an electric table saw, but if you can... And the table saw can't even be connected to the motor. But if the motor is screwed to the ground, bolted to the ground, and a belt is run from the pulley of the motor to the pulley of the chainsaw, of the table saw, then it's okay to use that table saw.
Now, you tell me, how does that, using a gas engine and a belt instead of an electric table saw, make it less likely that I'll run off to Bright Lights Big City and be lost to the Amish community?
Well, one thing is, if it's an electric saw, then you're tied to the grid. You're dependent on the larger society, right? Because
gasoline in the gas engine,
right? Because getting gas in a can is not the same as being connected to this big electric grid. But a lot of these things don't make tremendous sense to me right off the bat, or sometimes never.
What about the disabilities question that Al put out there? Do they accommodate, people who have disabilities? I've also heard, because courtship is kind of difficult with all the strictures there, what if an Amish, let's say, young woman has, diabetes, will she be married?
Yeah, let me answer the first one first about disability. Mental and physical disabilities, they basically like to take care of at home. The Schwarzentrubers, I'm not exactly sure how accommodating they would be. If somebody needed an artificial arm, I don't think it would happen. Mm. Near the end of my book, Samuel cuts off half of his finger and doesn't even look for it. He just goes in the house, has his wife fix it up, and he goes back to work.
Okay.
So there's a lot of, but mental, for instance, Samuel's stepmother, clearly has some mental disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
She is on some medication. They don't have a problem letting her have her psychotropic drugs to, you know, feel better or not stay in bed all day. They don't tolerate, like, someone saying, I'm depressed. That doesn't really fly in the Amish world. And they'd much rather have you take medication and get about your business.
What about marriage? And I don't know, is there an inbreeding issue here? I mean, in certain parts of the Amish world, I've seen a lot of short people. I don't know if that's, you know, common or just my peculiar intersection with the Amish.
Well, they don't want to do that. I think it used to be more common. There were some studies about a kind of an inbreeding coefficient in Wayne County where things got a little too close. I mean, even, you know, closer than second cousins, mm-hmm. say. But that's something that they don't want to do, that they go out of their way to try to find, you know, people they can marry who are not that close genetically. And generally, for the most part, that's gotten much, much better. But could I tell you, do you have time for one little anecdote?
Yes, please.
The children, Samuel's children live directly across the street from another Amish guy who's a really good friend of the family's. His name's Uriah. He has 15 children. Samuel has 9. They're both Schwarzentruppers. They're good friends. They go to the same school. Their children could not marry without being excommunicated and shunned.
Because?
Because when Samuel's church talked about adding a second lantern to the buggies, Uriah and his group and some other like-minded guys would not go along with it. So they started their own church. And even though they're good friends, that one lantern, is enough.
Wow.
Their split from the church was enough where their children could never marry.
That's taking it seriously and showing us the complexity of human interaction, even way down in the Schwarzentruber group. You end up saying, for all your friendship and for all your admiration, that your feelings about the Schwarzentruber Amish are conflicted. We've just got a minute. Give us a sense of that, Joe.
Well, there's so much about the life that I love. I mean, the way the family's together all the time, the astonishing way that the community works. Sometimes it's something as romantic and silly as the sound of the horse and buggy on the road, but a lot of it is how local they are, growing their own produce, selling their produce to the guy down the street. I think there's a lot we could learn from them. I'm still horrified by eighth grade education. I'm horrified by the fact that the man of the house, the father, has the most power, and then some, you know, 10-year-old girl would have hardly none at all. And if her father is a good, caring, loving man, then he'll be a good, caring, loving man with absolute authority. And if he's not those things, he'll be, you know, not the kind of person you want to have absolute authority over the next generation.
But he'll still have it in that role.
He'll have it. For sure.
Joe Mackle, we could go on and on. Maybe we'll get another chance one day. We really appreciate your time and the new book today, Plain Secrets, An Outsider Among the Amish. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
We'll go out with Each Day I'll Do a Golden Deed, Amish Singing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This evening sun
is sinking low.
Is sinking low.
A few more days.
A few more days.